Our Father in heaven, thank you for such a pure form of true religion as has been handed to us and taught to us. And thank you for the high degree of liberty that we have to practice that religion without being harassed for it. Thank you for all you did to make it be that way in this place and time. Please help us to learn about it and understand it. And please continue to bless us with that. And Lord, will you also please help our brothers and sisters who don't have it so good, that they may be faithful even if they don't have the liberty we have. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Friends and neighbors, the old quiz. I forgot to put anything about Lord Cecil's cupcakes. Those have to go with some other things. Question number one. What year did Mary become queen? What year did Princess Mary become Queen Mary the First? Question number two. About how many people were burned at the stake under Queen Mary the First? About how many people were burned at the stake under Queen Mary the First? Question number three. What was the name of the archbishop who was burned at the stake under Queen Mary the First? Speaking of burning people at the stake, who was the archbishop? There were three Oxford martyrs, right? Bishop Ridley, Bishop Latimer, and Archbishop. All right, question number four. How old was Elizabeth when she became queen? This is multiple choice. 15, 25, 35, or 45? How old was Elizabeth when she became queen? 15, 25, 35, or 45? You have more choices if you want. 55, 65, 75. Right. And question number five. What was the name of the Queen of Scotland and France in the time of Queen Elizabeth, who was a relative of Elizabeth's? What was the name of the Queen of Scotland and France in the time of Queen Elizabeth, who was a relative of Elizabeth's? All right, question number one. What year did Mary become queen?
1553.
Yep. About how many people were burned at the stake under Queen Mary the First?
300.
About 300. What was the name of the archbishop who was?
Cranmer.
Yes, Archbishop Thomas Cranmer. If you put Cranford Thompson, then that does not count. Okay. How old was Elizabeth when she became queen?
25.
25. And what was her relative who was queen of other countries at the same time?
Mary.
Because besides Elizabeth, everybody was named Mary. So. Okay. Official timeline. Now, let's see. How are we going to decide who gets to go? I've got it. Not by age, nor by, you know, your birthday, but by the number of your birthday that is the day of the month. Okay? In numerical order, by day of the month of your birthday. So who... Yours is the 16. Yours is 16.
Mm-hmm.
Yours is
11.
And yours is 9. Okay, so it's like that. Okay, if you please, miss.
1509, King Henry VIII ascends the throne of England. 1526, Tyndale's complete New Testament in English is printed.
1534, the Act of Supremacy officially separates the Church of England from the Pope.
1547, King Edward VI ascends the throne.
And so, in order to be fair, we're not going to just go back around. We'll start with you again and go back. So,
1553, Queen Mary I ascends the throne.
1560, Geneva Bible is published.
Nicely done. Congratulations, everyone. Now, today we'll add one, and this is out of order. It needs to go, needs to slip in before that last one. 1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne. Her coronation was not until the next year, but never mind that. 1558, Queen Elizabeth ascends the throne. I didn't used to know, like before last week, I didn't used to realize that some of the Marian exiles stayed in Geneva to finish the Geneva Bible before, even after they could have gone back. 1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne. Reading assignment for next week in your book by M.B. Singe, Chapter 8, Spain and the Sea Rovers. Our Bible verse for today, Proverbs 20:28. Proverbs 20:28. Proverbs 20:28. Miss Audrey, it was about to be your turn when we got to the end of the timeline. So would you please take a turn and read us this Bible verse? Proverbs 20:28.
Mercy and truth preserve the king, for his throne shall be established with mercy.
Amen. Thank you. Okay, friends and neighbors, we're talking in this class about how it was that the English-speaking people went from the prevailing religion being one that was seriously corrupt, and there being virtually no liberty for them to, for people to seek the, seek and find the true biblical religion, true biblical Christianity, you know, in around 1500 and for hundreds of years before that. And then by 1689, there's a General Assembly of Baptists in London where they openly proclaim the true biblical Christianity. And so we're looking at how God brought that about. Part of what we're doing, you know, is looking at the different rulers that God provided and the things that were done under their reign. Partly what we're doing is looking at the proliferation of Bible translating and publishing, the scriptures coming to us. So after Queen Mary the First, or Bloody Mary, we get the reign of Queen Elizabeth the First. Of course, we have now recently had the reign of Queen Elizabeth the Second, who reigned even longer. Queen Elizabeth the First was born 1533, began to reign, as you know, 1558. And she reigned until her death in 1603. Born 1533, began to reign 1558, reigned until her death 1603. Remember who her father was? King Henry VIII. Remember who her mother was? Anne Boleyn. And so Queen Elizabeth was 25 when she became queen. She had been very well homeschooled. She could speak other languages. She was apparently very bright and intelligent. She had received a very good homeschool education. At the time of her ascension, she was not married, and then she never married. Her chief advisor, as you read in your textbook, was William Cecil, was her main aide and advisor for 40 years. So, when you think of the reign of Queen Elizabeth, you should think of William Cecil alongside her. Very early on in her reign, she showed sympathy with and approval of Protestantism. Christmas, 1558. The Mass was still being held in the Roman Catholic style. And in the Mass, when the host was elevated, when the priest supposedly has had the elements turn into the actual body and blood of Christ, transubstantiation, it's then lifted for people to adore it. And at that point in the Mass, she got up and walked out in protest. How do you like that? That was Christmas, 1558. She was already queen, but it was before her coronation. January of 1559, in a procession, she was given an English translation Bible by the City of London as a gift, and she publicly embraced it and held it up. So very early on, she was showing that she was sympathetic with Protestantism. Remember that Roman Catholicism had been forcibly reimposed on the country for the previous 5 years. Now, here's a two-word term. It's very important in understanding these matters. The Elizabethan settlement. Elizabeth, with the words A-N attached. Elizabethan, you know, of Elizabeth. The Elizabethan settlement. That's the term for Elizabeth's policy regarding religion in what is called, or what was, you know, what was called the Church of England. You know, it's a point that's important to me for you all to understand. There really is no such thing as the Church of England, biblically speaking. That's a man-made structure that's not of Christ's ordaining. The Elizabethan settlement on the churches or congregations of England. And I'm going to talk to you about this subject, the Elizabethan settlement, in first something of what that was. Then Roman Catholic efforts to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement and Elizabeth's governmental efforts to oppose them. Then Protestant Puritan efforts to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement and Elizabeth's governmental efforts to oppose those. Okay, the Elizabethan settlement. Moderate measures to undo Queen Mary's moves back to Rome and Roman Catholicism without being too radical for Roman Catholic traditionalists to be able to tolerate them. Moderate measures to try to steer a course somewhere between what the Roman Catholics and the Pope would want and what the Protestants and the Puritan Protestants would want. 1559, a new act of supremacy. And now she is not going to be called the head of the Church of England, something that was more or less intolerable to everybody. She's going to be called the supreme governor of the church. Not that that's right either. But there's some wiggle room for people's consciences if she's not being called the head of the church. The Roman Catholics can only think of the Pope as the head of the church. The Protestants can only think of the Lord Jesus Christ as the head of the church. In the Act of Supremacy of 1559, she's called the governor of the church. Also in 1559, a prayer book, which is more or less the prayer book that they had under Edward VI. And then, of course, an accompanying act of uniformity. By law, every minister in every church has to use this prayer book, has to conduct worship accordingly. There is in this prayer book of 1559 Protestant language and Roman Catholic language. An attempt is being made to have the worship service conducted in a way that is not intolerable to Roman Catholics or to Protestants. I'm not commending these things. I'm telling you, this was the Elizabethan settlement. Among Mary, among Elizabeth, William Cecil, the House of Commons, the House of Lords, the bishops and archbishops, among all these different people, all the things that they want, the things that they hate, the things that they love, the things that they insist upon, the things that they reject, Elizabeth and her people are creating a settlement, attempting to have it be to where the most people involved can tolerate the way things are going to be. According to our author, 11 Catholic bishops were deprived of their office and their position filled by Protestant bishops, so that the government of the Church of England was more or less Protestant. Here's a phrase that I think I got from Dr. Wrightson. Elizabeth was instituting outward conformity while allowing some theological ambiguity. For something to be ambiguous means it's a little unclear what is meant by how it's worded, you know? So outwardly, all the ministers in the churches have to do what the prayer book says they have to do. But as to what exactly they believe, somebody says, this is the body and blood of Christ. As to what exactly he means by that, maybe those things could be left a little ambiguous. Via media. There's some Latin for you. Media, middle, via. You already know what via means? Right. Via media, a middle way, is the Latin term that was being used for this Elizabethan settlement. A via media. Early in her reign, Queen Elizabeth said this profound statement as to her policy. I will not make windows into men's souls. If she sees someone outwardly conforming to what is required by the church's policies, she will not insist on knowing exactly what he is thinking about it all. I will not make windows into men's souls. You know that in the time of Edward VI, the Roman Catholic idols were removed from many chapels. Her policy was images not already removed from chapels could remain there as long as they were not used idolatrously. They could be there in the chapels as long as people didn't pray to them, bow to them, treat them as idols. In the chapels, ornate stone structures typically had been set up in the front, in the middle, and referred to as the altar. Of course, an altar is someplace where sacrifice is made. In the Roman Catholic Mass, the concept is that Jesus Christ is being sacrificed over and over again. An intolerable idea in true biblical Christianity. And so in the reign of Edward VI, a lot of the altars were removed, replaced by simple wooden tables. And so in the reign of Elizabeth, as part of the Elizabethan settlement, the Via Media, her policy was that there would be tables, not altars, but the table could be sitting right in the same place where the altar had been. Here's something I find particularly interesting in a number of ways. The issue of the rood screens. Rood, not spelled like the word a rude person, but rood, R-O-O-D. Rood screens. Now, you know the word cross. And the word cross is not an English word in origin, it's Latin. Do you know the Latin word for cross? Crux, C-R-U-X. And that's where we get crucifixion, crucifix, stuff like that. And cross is just the Anglicization of that Latin word. The English word was rood. Similar, probably the same word as our modern word rod. So a cross was referred to as a rood. And a rood screen was a display in the front of a chapel on which the cross was placed with a depiction of Jesus on the cross. The thing that we now hear referred to as a crucifix, that was part of the rood screen. Rood screen being an old name for it from when those things were still called by English words. The rood screen was a tremendous offense to the Protestants, and they wanted the rood screen removed out of all the chapels. Queen Elizabeth allowed that the rood screens were to be removed from any chapels where they still were, except hers. In her private chapel, she wanted the rood screen to remain. I don't have any window into her soul, so I don't know exactly what her thinking was. Matthew Parker was Archbishop of Canterbury. He had conformed instead of going into exile. So he was there were a lot of clergy who did that, who didn't really like what Queen Mary was doing, but had conformed. Generally speaking, the clergy were not purged, meaning there was not a going through all the priests in England, getting rid of all the Roman Catholics. But ones that openly opposed Elizabeth or her policies, they were removed. Here's a term for you. Recusancy. R-E-C-U-S-A-N-C-Y. R-E-C-U-S-A-N-C-Y. Recusancy. You hear a form of that word today typically just in legal or political matters, where somebody is said to recuse himself. For example, if a matter appeared before the Supreme Court and it was a matter pertaining to a close relative of one of the justices, then that justice would recuse himself. He would absent himself from the court for that particular case. Recusancy is being absent from church on Sunday, being in non-attendance on the Lord's Day in the assembly. And what Elizabeth did was, she left the policy of fines for recusancy in place, but she made the fines extremely small. So it was still technically illegal to be absent from the Church of England, but people could afford it if they decided to. So there's a very brief explanation to you all of the Elizabethan settlement. Now, this was arrived at, you know, discussions, negotiations, many among the parties involved. Having arrived at those policies, the necessary laws and policies in the church, Elizabeth then did not want to persecute anyone for slight lack of conformity to these things. But she also would not allow any further reforms or any returns to something more Roman Catholic. She wanted there to be no further Protestantizing of the church, no further reform of it, and no returns toward Roman Catholicism, and no strict, harsh punishment of those who were going to fudge a little. I think I got that term, fudging slightly, from Dr. Wrightson. The Elizabethan settlement. Now, you can picture what it would be like to be a Puritan when that had all been settled, and what it would like to be a Roman Catholic when all of that had been settled. It basically pleased nobody. And it's just that it was her way of trying to have one religion in England that everybody could tolerate. Now, of course, that sounds terrible to us, and it really is terrible. But that was how far things had come. You know, the wonderfully clear ideas we have now about biblical religion and the government securing our right to worship as our conscience dictates, those are later developments. You know, this is a thing that is moving along, and this is where they've got to in the time of Elizabeth. This is what she thinks is best. And so it basically displeased everybody. Therefore, both Roman Catholics and Protestants worked to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement, because they were not pleased with how it was. So I'm going to talk to you just very briefly about some efforts made by Roman Catholics to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement. Priests, Roman Catholic priests, were being trained to be smuggled back to England. It's known that at least 500 priests were smuggled into England during Elizabeth's reign. And this move came to be thought of as associated not just with religion, but also with foreign policy regarding Spain. You know, Spain was a big, powerful, the most powerful country in Europe or even in the world at the time, and they were thoroughly Roman Catholic. They had succeeded violently putting down the Protestant movement in Spain. And so it seemed to the English like the constant smuggling of Roman Catholic priests back into England was not only a religious thing, but possibly a political thing also. So the Roman Catholics were doing that. We'll talk another time, God willing, about Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, Roman Catholic. You read this week about how she was deposed when her boyfriend tried to blow up her husband, but didn't succeed in blowing up her husband, so I had to kill him in the backyard. When all of that happened, she was deposed and fled to England. Elizabeth put her under house arrest. You know, you may live in this castle and be comfortable and waited on, but you can't leave. She was the nearest claimant to the throne of England, and so there were numerous plots by Roman Catholics to get rid of Elizabeth and put Mary on the throne, not to be confused with Queen Mary the First, who had died by then. So there were a number of plots. For example, in 1569, the revolt of the Northern Earls. The plot was to release Mary, to spring her from captivity in whichever state she was being held at the time, and marry her to the Duke of Norfolk, a Roman Catholic sympathizer. And then to coordinate with the Spanish to use their army to depose Elizabeth and put Mary and the Duke of Norfolk on the throne, being Roman Catholics. That plot was discovered and was not successful. There were numerous other such plots throughout these years.
How do you spell Norfolk?
N-O-R-F-O-L-K. N-O-R-F-O-L-K. Norfolk. I have it in my notes as the 1569 Revolt of the Northern Earls. I don't know if that's a term used in the history of this or not. It's a description of it. I don't know if that term is used as a term. Talking to you about Roman Catholic attempts to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement. In 1570, the Pope excommunicated Elizabeth and absolved her subjects from obedience to her. He pronounced that if any of her subjects disobeyed her, it was not sinful, since she shouldn't be queen and isn't legitimately queen, and since she's excommunicated from the church, any of her subjects who disobey her are absolved from any guilt. The most well-known and obvious thing that the Roman Catholics did to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement was that in 1588, the King of Spain, Philip II, previously married to Mary I, previously the King of England, kind of. King of England, you know, of a sort. He sent the famous Spanish armada. I'm hoping to have our whole lesson next time be up on the Spanish armada episode. So throughout Queen Elizabeth's reign, there were Roman Catholic efforts to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement. The government then, under Elizabeth, made moves to counter these Roman Catholic measures. For example, in 1581, Parliament and the Queen made it law that it was treason against England to be absolved by the Pope and reconciled to the Catholic Church. The people of England, in declaring Elizabeth the governor of the church, and in re-separating themselves from Rome, they had, according to the Pope, committed a sin there in being in schism with the Pope. And he offered, to absolve them of that guilt if they would be reconciled to him. The Queen and the Parliament finally found it necessary to declare that treason against England. If anybody went through that ceremony of being absolved of that sin and reconciled to the Pope, that was considered treason against England. The recusancy fines, which, as I mentioned, were originally set extremely low, were increased to 400 times what they had been. If it was $1 to be absent from church at the beginning, eventually they made it $400 to be absent from church. In 1585, England declared war on Spain, and they sent help to support the Protestants in the Netherlands, fighting to try to be out from under the King of Spain. Also in 1585, the law was passed declaring it treason for a Catholic priest even to be in England. And so, over the course of the next 20 years or so, 131 priests were executed for treason. 131 Catholic priests executed for treason, their very presence in England being legally considered treason. In 1586, Mary, Queen of Scots, was finally tried for treason. Somebody considered that she was actively participating in the various plots to have her made queen. She was found guilty and in 1587 executed. She was beheaded. I mentioned one of the moves that the Roman Catholics made to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement was to muster the Spanish Armada, try to invade and conquer England for Spain and for Roman Catholicism. In 1588, under the Queen's leadership, the people of England produced a great mobilization. Men of the country, of the kingdom, taking up arms in great numbers, and the ship owners and captains and sailors producing a fleet to counter the Armada. So all during her reign, she was attempting to maintain this via media, this settlement, where there's no further reform and no return to Roman Catholicism. And Roman Catholics were trying to undermine it, and she was trying to counter those moves. But it wasn't only the Roman Catholics who were trying to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement. It was also the Puritans. So there were trends, activities among the Protestants to try to undermine this via media. There was a term in use at the time to describe the Protestants who were doing this kind of thing, quote, the hotter sort of Protestants, unquote. I heard that from Dr. Wrightson, but I don't think it was made up by him. I think he was referring to it as something that was being said of them at the time. They thought of the church as being only about half reformed the way it was, and they desired further reformation. Now, in our modern Reformed Baptist movement, we're used to this, to having heard these kind of things. They desired to get rid of the rest of Roman Catholicism in worship, the vestiges of it, which they referred to as the rags of Rome, and other such uncomplimentary terms. Something that is a vestige is something that's left over from previous use, that is no longer of any use or any desirable use. And so in the way that worship was being conducted under Queen Elizabeth, some of the idolatrous practices from before were no longer being done. But some of the furnishings in the chapel that had been used for that idolatrous practices were still there. The clergy were still being required to wear the weird outfits that they had been required to wear under the Pope. They desired to get rid of these vestiges, the rags of Rome. We've heard them referred to as the scraps of the whore. We're referring to the whore in the book of Revelation. They were increasingly being influenced by the writings of John Calvin. They were having more preaching than just in the regular church services. They were having public preaching on market days in the market towns. They were having meetings that they called prophesyings. These hotter sort of Protestants were believing in and desiring a reform in the form of church government. The Church of England had had a hierarchical or episcopal form of government for hundreds of years. There's somebody at the top. Under him, you know, there's the Pope or a monarch at the top. Under him are archbishops. Under them are bishops. Under them are local pastors and other all kinds of different officers. A hierarchical form of government, which in the case of church is called an episcopal, meaning of bishops, an episcopal form of government. And there was the growing belief in and desire for a Presbyterian form of church government. That's where the presbyters or elders of every church govern that church. And then those presbyters have form a council with the presbyters of surrounding churches and make rulings for those churches. But then there's not a top-down episcopal hierarchical system. That was growing, that idea was growing in influence in 1570. I keep trying to say 1970 when I'm looking at 1570. In 1570, a teacher at Cambridge named Thomas Cartwright gave a series of lectures, very, very influential, about rejecting episcopal government and embracing Presbyterian government. He was fired from Cambridge for giving those lectures. Time after time in Parliament, bills were introduced to revise the prayer book and other things regarding further reform, further Protestant reform of the church. So, again, the government took moves to counter those Protestant Puritan moves at undoing the Elizabethan settlement. For example, in 1576, Queen Elizabeth banned all discussion in Parliament of further reforms to the church. Seems crazy to us, right? The head of state tells the legislature, you may not even talk about this, but that's what she did. That's what how it was. In 1577, Elizabeth ordered the Archbishop of Canterbury to close all the prophesying meetings. Extra meetings, we would say something like Bible conferences. You know how we've gone to a family camp or a pastor's conference or something where it's not just the usual preaching on the Lord's Day, but other days where pastors and others get together and have extra preaching. She ordered the Archbishop to close them all, but he wouldn't. And then, this is his last name, Grindal, G-R-I-N-D-A-L. I don't have his first name handy. Elizabeth ordered Archbishop Grindal to close all of those preaching meetings. He wouldn't. So she suspended him. She didn't remove him from his office, didn't burn him at the stake, didn't imprison him, didn't kill him. She suspended him. He could no longer do his official functions, and she left it like that for 6 years until he died. That's probably a really good example where you can see her trying to have the middle way. She's not going to allow further reform, these extra preaching meetings and stuff, but she's also not going to burn the Archbishop at the stake for not canceling them. In 1583, she appointed John Whitgift, Archbishop of Canterbury, when Archbishop Grindal died. He was Protestant in doctrine, but committed to upholding her policies, the Elizabethan settlement. And he passed three articles for the clergy, for all the ministers in the Church of England. Here are the three articles. One, recognition of royal supremacy. That the monarch is the supreme governor of the Church of England. A clergyman had to agree to that. Recognition of the 39 articles. I need to tell you all more about this. I probably should have today, but I forgot about it. You know, we had the 42 articles that were passed right near the end, right before King Edward VI died. The 39 articles are a modified form of that, lacking some of the strong anti-Roman Catholic language. He insisted on recognition of the 39 articles. And he made them take an oath that nothing in the current prayer book was contrary to the Word of God. If they would not swear to that, then they could not be clergymen. So, government moves against the Protestant moves to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement. Now, I am not, through any of this, trying to defend to you the Elizabethan settlement. I suppose were I alive at the time, if I thought like I do now and I were alive then, I would have been among the hotter sort of Protestants, I suppose. Although, you know, who knows in different circumstances how I would have reacted. I don't mean to claim any virtue for myself compared with others, but I just mean I do not defend to you her policies. You can recognize that during her long reign, from what year? 1558. Mary began to reign in 1553, right? 1558, until she died, 1603. All during that time, there was not a big civil war. They did not go back to the Pope. And so there was, politically speaking, a successful keeping of the country essentially unified for all her reign by this policy. You could praise possibly the political success of it, but I don't mean to praise the religious purity of it, which it was not, you know, biblically pure. And I think it would be good to point out, part of that is because keeping a country politically united and keeping all religion in the country united is not rightly the function of the civil government, because the civil government is not rightly the supreme governor of the church. The congregations under Jesus Christ should govern themselves, recognizing his lordship and operating according to his word. And then a monarch doesn't have to try to maintain national unity by maintaining a uniform religion that everybody can tolerate. But that was how they thought at the time. Now, at this point, I can mention to you Protestant efforts in the country at the time, other than political, not involving bills in Parliament and things like that. During this time, a small minority of Christians were separating from the Church of England to form new congregations not part of the Church of England. 1582, there was a treatise published, very influential, by a person named Robert Brown, Brown with an E on the end. 1582, Robert Brown, a treatise of reformation without tarrying for any. The hotter sort of Protestants who wanted to further reform the Church of England, but realized they were going to have to wait for certain people to come, powerful people to come along with it, were saying, you know, we need to wait, we need to tarry, waiting while Queen Elizabeth or whoever comes along with us. He advocated reforming the churches now without tarrying for any. And people were doing that. There were new congregations forming during Elizabeth's reign, the second half of the 1500s. There were others who were actively engaged in evangelism, telling the gospel within the Church of England, attempting to transform the church in spirit, even if it could not at that time be reformed in structure. And I'm going to read you a quote from Dr. Wrightson here. They advocated a religion heavily based upon the Bible, advocated preaching, sanctification of the Sabbath, insisting upon strict moral behavior, pursuing moral reformation where they had the power and the opportunity, and they constantly drummed upon the theme of the failure of England as a country to show proper gratitude for God's deliverance, and the need to turn to a more strict religious observation in return for God's favor. Now, Dr. Wrightson is not a preacher or an advocate for Protestantism or anything. Seemed like a very kind of neutral historian person, but it seems like he really put his finger there on that. That all sounds very familiar to us. That, you know, basically our religious attitudes were very much what was going under the surface unofficially in the Church of England during Queen Elizabeth's reign. They found that they could not change the law governing religion. They could not change the Queen's policies, could not get bills through Parliament to change things officially, but they were preaching and living essentially what we see as biblical Christianity within that structure. As an example, William Perkins. William Perkins, who interestingly lived almost exactly the same years as Elizabeth's rule. He lived entirely during her reign. Now, I shouldn't have said that. I'm not sure he wasn't born right before she became the queen. William Perkins, who lived 1558 to 1602, there are a lot of English Protestant Puritan names that get more mileage now and come through our ears much more often than William Perkins. But at the time, he was by far the most influential Protestant in England. William Perkins was on faculty at Cambridge, and he was a church pastor 18 years, conforming to the requirements of the Elizabethan settlement in his official ministry. But then he wrote and published prolifically on Reformed theology. And his influence within the Church of England for biblical Christianity in that way was tremendous. At the time, his writings were outselling all other religious authors, even John Calvin. So I'm showing you that there, I'm telling you these things as part of you understanding that the Protestant moves to try to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement were not all official and political. Some of them were unofficial, either Christians withdrawing and forming new congregations, or preaching and living biblical Christianity, even in the middle of the structures that were not. So, we still have some more things to talk about in future lessons about how the Lord blessed us during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. But to conclude this part of our consideration of that time, Queen Elizabeth died 1603. And what was the situation then? What had God done through her for our benefit as to religious liberty? Well, remember when King Edward died. Then the next monarch was able to just take the country back to Roman Catholicism. When that Roman Catholic monarch died, then there was a very strong conflict. Are we going to have a Protestant monarch, or are we going to have a Roman Catholic monarch? Well, by the time she died, 1603, the threat that Roman Catholicism would be reinstituted officially in Great Britain was greatly reduced. Now looking back in history, it in fact did not ever happen. The Puritan form of Christianity had not become officially instituted, but had become highly influential in the Church of England. The separatist churches had begun forming. Our modern Reformed Baptist movement and 1689 Confession come from that movement. People determining that they cannot in good conscience stay with the Church of England. So that movement had started. There had been a shift where the two strong competing religious ideologies were no longer Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. There had been this shift one notch over to where now there was still competing religious ideologies, but it was Protestantism of a moderate sort and a more radical Protestantism of the Puritan kind. So it was no longer, are we going to be Roman Catholic or are we going to be Protestant? It was now, okay, we're Protestant. Are we going to be kind of a moderate Protestant or more zealous Protestantism? So those are some of the things that we can observe and say, the Lord has blessed us to bring us to where we are now. And there's what he did, a quick summary of what he did through her and in her time. Well, that's all for now, friends.